Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 4th of March. We have two absolutely fabulous hours for you today. There are days I always like to come to work, but these books are just so good and the people have so much to them that I know you're going to enjoy both hours. Jim Wallace will be joining us momentarily. His latest book is Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. About a year ago, he was invited to participate in the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, and he decided to talk to all the CEOs and heads of state about Gandhi's seven deadly social sins. How's this for you? Wish it were on tape. Politics without principle, wealth without work, commerce without morality, pleasure without conscience, education without character, science without humanity, and worship without sacrifice. The book, he says, is intended to ask the right question, and he does that and more in his book. He has a long, long history of working for the good. And he will be with us momentarily. Our number two, Patti Smith, will be with us. She has written one beautiful book. She is one heck of a writer. I knew she was a poet, but I hope this is the first of many memoirs. It's about her relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe, and it's very good. So she joins us, our number two. Hey, we're rolling. It's good. It's going to be a good day. I'm wanting to tell you that we are listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. It is our winter membership drive. Lisa Nalbandian is joining me, our regional manager here in Milwaukee, and we are asking today for your support of the programs that you enjoy on this station. Make your gift now, please, at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. The amount is up to you. We appreciate every donation because the dollar you give makes a difference, and this book, which is our premium this hour, Rediscovering Values for a $150 pledge, is something that can change a lot of people's lives, and that's a good thing. So please give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Hello, Lisa.
Hello, Kathleen. Well, we have a goal this hour, and that goal is to get to 25 pledges before 10 o'clock. And you can help us meet this important goal by making a contribution right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And just remember that your gift ensures that the programs you enjoy will be here every day on Wisconsin Public Radio. Contribute at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
In just a minute, we'll be speaking to Jim Wallace. Jim has been for many years working on issues like poverty and hunger. He is he's president and founder of Sojourners Magazine. Many of you are familiar with that. He has given his really studied thought about all kinds of issues on CBS, NBC. He was on recently with Jon Stewart on this particular book. He has taught at Harvard's Divinity School, the Kennedy School of Government, and he talks about why things are off here in this book, why it is that we're asking what's the fastest way to make money and how do you beat your coworkers for the next promotion instead of what is the common good. It's an important conversation. We will have it momentarily, a $150 pledge, and you'll be able to receive this book and then pass it around so other people can read it as well. WPR.org is the web, and the phone number is 888-202-2552.
And giving takes just 3 minutes of your time. You tell us your name, your contact information, how much you want to give, and how much you want to pay. And remember, using your credit card will save us time, money, and paper. So take those 3 minutes right now. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I know there have been many times you've been listening to the Ideas Network, and this is going to happen today as well, believe me. You've heard something that stopped you in your tracks, something that was really interesting, and we strive every day for programs that open your eyes, engage your brain, tug at your heart, programs that affect your life. This kind of radio happens only with your financial support. Please support this hour. We have a goal of 25 calls this hour, and it is an hour you'll be able to receive Jim Wallace's book for a $150 pledge. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
So give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Help pay for the programs that you depend on. Help us meet this goal of 25 pledges this hour by making your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And remember, when you pledge $120 or more, you can choose Food for 40 as a thank you gift. And the thank you gift will provide 40 meals to those facing hunger in your area. For more information about Food for 40 and to make your pledge, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Thanks very much, Lisa. And just to let you know where we are, a goal of 25 calls this hour. We have 3 calls right now. And listen to the conversation and please pledge during the hour, too. Those lines will be open. Jim Wallace is with us this hour. Jim has a new book, and it came out of conversations he had almost a year ago in January, well, more than a year ago, January of 2009. He was invited to participate in the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, where all the CEOs and heads of state were asked by Wallace, how will this economic crisis change us? How will it change the ways that we think, act, and decide things, how we prioritize and value our success, how we do business, and how we live our lives? And that is a change from the kinds of questions that we have been asking, prompted in too big a measure by television and magazines and our whole popular culture. How do you beat your coworkers for the next promotion? Are you keeping up with the Joneses? What do you need to buy next that will truly make you happy? And so we're going to be talking about all of these issues and the huge gap between those who have and those who have not and the banking crisis and all of that. Jim Wallace is a best-selling author. He is a wonderful speaker and preacher, a public theologian, and an international commentator on religion and public life, faith, and politics. President and CEO of Sojourners, where he is the editor-in-chief. I saw him recently on The Daily Show with Jim Stewart, which was a nice piece. He has taught at Harvard. He has taught at the Kennedy School of Government, and he is the author of a number of books, and I think I've spoken with him over the years. I've been talking with Jim Wallace for a long, long time, and we've spoken about almost all of his books, if not all. For you to join us on air this hour, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. For you to ask your questions of Jim Wallace. Hey, Jim, how are you?
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Jim.
We have been talking for a long time.
I know.
It's been great to be on your show, always.
Great to have you here. And I saw you on The Daily Show with Jim Stewart, and I thought, isn't this wonderful? There you are on The Daily Show. It says something about that show, and it says something about Stewart. A lot of people say a lot about you as well, but wasn't that a nice piece to be able to be there?
Well, I was watching Jon Stewart when I came back from Davos. And the first time, and you know, he had Jim Cramer on from Mad Money, and he really was kind of a moral confrontation you often don't see in the media. He said there are two economies. One's this game, this casino gambling adventure that you talk about every day, and the other one's the real economy of real people, and your adventure is costing real pain. And I watched this, and then I was speaking in the National Cathedral that next Sunday, and my text was, the text they gave me was, Jesus overturning the money changers' tables in the temple.
Oh, my gosh.
And I said, I just saw Jon Stewart do that. I just saw him overturn the money changers' tables, you know, Jim Cramer's tables in the temple. And so my sermon was Sunday School with Jon Stewart.
Oh, I love it.
And that's the first chapter of the book now. So then Jon had me back on again, and we had a great time, as we always do. But, you know, there's very few places other than great shows like yours, but the mainstream media. I said I wish I'd had a chapter in the book about airport security and one about Tiger Woods, you know, because that's all they want to talk about. But the book is about the values crisis that's underneath this economic crisis.
Yeah. You remind us of, and they're kind of the thing you want to put on your refrigerator and look at every day, and I really wonder what the reaction was as you were speaking to these CEOs and heads of state about
right.
Gandhi's seven deadly social sins.
Well, first of all, you know, this is not my usual crowd, Kathleen. Let me tell you.
No, I'm sure it's not.
And there was a panel discussion on values and the market, and Tony Blair was on the panel with me. The next day he said, Jim, they must be in crisis to have a panel on values in the market and invite someone like you to speak. This is not this year, but last year. And so, you know, I had all these CEOs, and I said, every morning you wake up in your hotel rooms, you watch the same reporter from CNN ask one of you the same question, when will the crisis end? And I said, sorry, but that's the wrong question. The question should be, how will the crisis change us? I held up my hand and I said, you all know about the invisible hand of the market Adam Smith talked about in The Wealth of Nations. What do you do when the invisible hand lets go of the common good? And you could hear a gasp in the room. Then I gave him Gandhi's seven deadly sins. And for 3 days, I was having these really soul-searching, pastoral, confessional conversations with these CEOs saying, what was number four again? And they're right. So, and then this year, after that, they had this wide conversation about the values issue. And usually at Davos, these issues are a sidebar. So if you want to hear them, you hear Jim Wallis and Mohammed Yunus at 7 a.m. on the 14th floor. This time, Mohammed Yunus and I were on this panel in the opening day with CEOs, and the topic was values in the post-crisis world. So the conversation wants to happen even there, but it certainly is happening on Main Street all over the country.
You talk about, and I'd like to go into history for a little while here, that we need to uncover some forgotten lessons that have served us well in the past when people enjoyed the fruits of their labor. When was that past, Jim? Well, and what was it like?
Well, I remember my Depression-era parents really didn't spend money they didn't have for things they didn't need.
Right.
And it was less keeping up with the Joneses, as I say in the book, but checking on the Joneses to make sure they're okay. That was a different kind of ethic there. And what I say in the book is this bad morality play of banks and bailouts and bonuses, that has our attention and should, and I want to talk about that. But the bank bonuses really are a symptom of a deeper societal erosion of values. And these new maxims, Kathleen, have really overtaken us, really seduced us, really. And they're like the three I lift up in the book are, greed is good, it's all about me, and I want it now. Mm-hmm. And those kind of maxims kill economies and cultures and families and really our very souls. But to counter that, I'm talking about some of the new old virtues, like enough is enough, and we're in this together. And I love the Native American indigenous people's ethic that you evaluate decisions today by their impact on the seventh generation out.
Yeah,
now,
too.
That would change things.
Yes, that certainly would change things. The book is filled with all kinds of interesting information, which I never knew. You talk about these, and I'd like to cite them in a moment, the incredible gap between those who have and those who haven't. It's
right.
Sinful. It's terrible. But also, at a time, I never knew that Bank of America, can you talk about its Italian origins and how they have changed? They've just changed radically.
Well, they started as a community bank, and they pioneered this sort of branch banking, neighborhood banks, and it really was quite a history. But there I was, standing on the Treasury building steps before Christmas, and I was doing a press conference with people who had been foreclosed on or about to be foreclosed on. And they were mostly Latina, African-American, first-time home buyers. And they were there telling their stories. And I was supposed to provide, you know, a religious perspective or something at the end. And the woman who spoke before me was named Mercy Martinez, and she was nervous about being in Washington and telling her story. And she just told how she'd saved all her money, could have had a fixed-rate mortgage, but got trapped in one of these time-bomb mortgages, and now lost her job. And she just started to cry. And, you know, I, as a pastor, I just kind of walked up and gave her a hug, and she was drying her tears, and I just got angry. There I am in the Treasury steps. White House is right there. Obama is talking to the bankers while we speak, and right down the block is the Bank of America. Huge edifice there. And I learned at that point they had forgiven or I mean, modified. They'd modified only 100 loans nationwide. That was it. And I just told the story about the parable of the unmerciful servant in the Gospels, where a master forgives the debt of a servant who owes him money, and the servant goes out and won't forgive anybody else's debt who owes him money, and the master gets angry. And so these banks got bailed out. We extended grace to them because we were afraid of a meltdown, and they've extended no grace to anybody else. They took our money, they made themselves even richer, and now they're giving bonuses, $150 billion of bonuses to their executives. And so after that day, Joy and I decided, my wife and I, to fire Bank of America. And we did. We took our money out and put it in a local bank that's been more responsible, and now a mini movement is beginning all over the country. Yes. Others are doing the same thing. And so, and John Stewart, I said, so let's fire Bank of America. The banks say they're too big to fail. I say, let's make them smaller.
I did the same thing a couple of weeks ago,
good
and it really felt wonderful.
Yeah.
It just, and then you, and I put money in a credit union, and then now that people know who you are and you walk in, how can I help you? It's a whole different atmosphere.
Exactly. And I tell, you know, I'm not against the hardware store on the corner, or even the local bank. And I tell a story in the book about Ron Hermance, a banker in Hudson City Bank in New Jersey. And his colleague said, you know, Ron, you got to bundle these mortgage securities and sell them off, you know. Start using them for risky investments. We're going to make a lot of money here. He said, well, I've got this problem. It's our tradition of having a relationship with our customers. So we know where our loans are, and they know where their money is and all the rest. Yeah, but Ron, we're going to make a bundle. He says, no, I think I'm not going to do that. So he ends up on the cover of Fortune this past year as Banker of the Year because he didn't need a bailout. And the funny thing, he won the first annual George Bailey Award. You remember Jimmy Stewart,
of
Wonderful
course.
Life?
Yes.
And so Ron walks down the street and says, hey, George! You know, and he loves that. So there are better behaviors out there, but not being undertaken by Bank of America, by Citi, by Chase. The big banks have really behaved very badly here. And their colleagues from Wall Street quietly described to me their behavior as greedy, reckless, and very risky.
Mm. And the bank, was it the Bank of America or another place that was started because it was giving loans to Italians who couldn't find loans elsewhere?
Yeah, I think there's all this history, kind of, you know, the George Bailey savings and loan ethic of banking, that banks are there to build up a community and help the community go forward and help people's, you know, families and lives to improve. But that's, these same banks own about 90% of the credit card business.
Goodness.
And Elizabeth Warren, this wonderful, I'm at Harvard right now, I'm a Harvard law professor, economist. She's been brilliant. She's talking about the need for a consumer financial protection agency, and reminds us that not too long ago, credit cards had a one-page application. Mortgages only two or three, and now they're 30 and 50. Mm. And the fine print is meant to deceive us and cheat us. And they're making enormous sums of money here. And the rules of the road that we put in after the Great Depression in the 30s have been quietly removed by these banks and corporations who have lobbied Congress to remove them.
And where are we in this process? Why aren't we marching in the streets over this, Jim? It really is terribly immoral.
It is, and this is where I on Sojo.net, our website, I did this long talk with Elizabeth. Your listeners would love to hear her. She just lays it out very clearly. And what she says in answer to your question is, most of us don't really know what's going on. Hard to get your head around the financial regulatory battles in the Congress. But the banks know what's going on, and they're in the Senate offices virtually every day. So it really is time to call our senators and say, look, there's got to be some rules here. There's got to be some accountability here. Just do what we've had before. And But they spent $200 million, the banks, on keeping themselves from getting regulated for the common good. This is a sin of biblical proportions here. And so we're organizing church leaders and pastors and other faith leaders and anybody, really, to call their senator and say, we need a freestanding, serious consumer financial protection agency.
Jim Wallace, our guest, and we're going to welcome phone calls. Our lines are filled for him. That's good. This is the thing about public radio. It's a place where people have righteous indignation about some of these issues and are incredibly well informed about them and take action. Jim has been working at issues of poverty and fairness for a long time. His latest book is very good, Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. And I find myself in the somewhat strange position. We're in a pledge drive as well, but as you know, we are a pretty lean machine here at Wisconsin Public Radio. We don't make very much money. It's really true, but it's the ideas that we love talking about and what is keeping us here talking about all of these important issues with you and with marvelous guests. So if you could do this, this would be great. This is a really good hour for you to pledge because I guarantee you that Jim's book will inspire you and probably move you to some kind of action. And with your pledge, then you don't hold on to the book. Then you read the book and you give it to somebody else and somebody else and somebody else. So your $150 pledge will go a long, long way. We ask you please to pledge this hour, and you can do so by going to WPR.org or 888-202-2552, 888-202-2552. $150 if you can afford it, or maybe you can pool your money with your friends and get this book and, oh yeah, have a book club. That's a good idea. Have a book club on these kinds of issues. That's a good idea. I do say so myself. All right, two more your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to a couple of phone calls now for Jim Wallace. Ray is first from Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Good morning to you and your guests. I really appreciate the show, and I agree with everything your guest has said so far this morning. I want to suggest why we're not marching in the street, Kathleen. It might be because if you march enough in this country, you're going to wind up on a no-fly list. Just ask Amy Goodwin from Democracy Now! About protesting and being involved in protests. I think we're really having a chilling effect in this country because of the Patriot Act. But my question is, would the guests like to expand a little bit on what if at the turn of the century when the oil barons and the railroad barons were so big they were putting this country at risk, what if at that time, instead of what the country did at that time, we broke those companies up into smaller companies? Standard Oil, I mean, all these oil companies came out of the one, and all these railroad companies came out of the other. Well, what if at that time we had did what we're doing now with the banks, where we just propped them up and let them stay giant edifices that actually threaten our country more than any terrorist could, because the threat is from within our country?
Jim.
Well, this is a period that we need to, that Ray's talking about, we need to lift up. There was a tremendous populist progressive movement, and in fact, it had a lot of religious roots to it back then. I mean, evangelical preachers were economic populists, and they were taking on the banks in a regular way. And what Kathleen talked about earlier about the gaps, here's what I learned in research for this book, that the gaps, the peak time of the greatest gaps between the top and the bottom of our society occurred the year before the Great Depression, and now the year before the Great Recession. So when the gaps get too big, that's the name of the chapter, things begin to unravel, and the economy itself begins to fall apart. I mean, even Adam Smith, who coined the invisible hand image in his previous book, The Wealth of Nations, The Moral Sentiments, he said, when there's no moral framework, the market can't even function properly. And Joseph Schumpeter said, the Austrian economist, when there's no ethical sensibility, the market ends up devouring every other sector and finally devours even itself. And that's what we've seen now. So Ray is right. We're going to need populist, popular movements that really take on the banks and take on Wall Street. And the sad thing, it's really a handful of banks here who have caused, who precipitated the financial crisis, led to the economic recession in my hometown of Detroit. Almost one of every two workers is looking for a job.
One out of two workers.
I mean,
the official rate's
30%, but it's just been there. And it's huge. My brother runs the biggest neighborhood service organization in the city, and it's just incredible. And so when are we going to hold these people accountable? As Ray said, we used to, and we did. We had movements that did that, but it won't happen from Washington and certainly not from Wall Street. So it's going to have to be real citizen movement saying fairness and protection of ordinary families. This is a family issue. If you care about families, this is a family issue now.
And give me those figures again, because they bear knowing and repeating. The top 400 people and the bottom 50%, what are they specifically, Jim?
Just take CEO salaries to average worker salaries.
Okay.
30 years ago, the ratio was about 30 to 1 or so. Now it's 415 to 1.
Oh.
I mean, does anybody think this is good. This is a good thing for our solidarity, for a sense of belonging, for the society. The percentages of the wealth concentration. Louis Brandeis, Supreme Court Justice, once said, "You either have concentration of wealth, or you have democracy, but you can't have both." And so we've seen this grow and grow and grow, these great gaps. And now, when they grow too large, everything does come unraveled here.
Yeah. What about those people you were talking about earlier, those people who are nameless, but they've talked to you about the work they're doing and the greed thereafter? Why aren't their hearts troubled by all of this? How many have had awakenings or said, wait a second, I shouldn't be making this kind of money. Nobody should make this kind of money.
Well, I think there is some soul searching going on, but the same people who are doing the soul searching often tell me, but at the top, there is this really ruthless economic motivation here. Some CEOs tell me we've been infected by what they call short-termism. The metric is profit in the quarterly profit loss statement, and it's all about shareholders and not about the other stakeholders in capitalism, which are workers and consumers and the environment and the next generation out. But I think I'm going to business schools, which is a good thing. They're inviting this conversation. And we're having a good discussion. But somehow a values conversation has to lead to different behaviors, because bad values produce some very horrible outcomes, and some better values have to lead to different decisions. And so the good thing about a crisis, Kathleen, it is an opportunity. And my sixth grade son is, my 11-year-old son is studying Chinese, and he was reminded the other day that the symbol for crisis in Chinese is the combination of the two symbols for danger and opportunity. So we have a moment here, and that's why the book is just intended to start a conversation, in congregations and small groups and in Wall Street and Capitol Hill. Let's have a national conversation about what kind of country do we want to be, and what would an economy that really has the common good as a metric or as for accountability would look like. What does a common good economy look like? That's a conversation I think the country is really, really begging to have.
Thanks, Ray, for your call. Earl is next from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Good morning. I was going to ask the guest if he's heard of our book, which I think is a classic from back around 1970, by E.F. Schumacher, called Small is Beautiful, which outlines a lot of things he's mentioning about the financial markets. But to me, it's led to things like local credit unions. Here in Medford, we just went to our annual meeting of the credit union. They report a very, very low delinquency rate, I think less than 1%.
Well, I have all of Schumacher's books on my shelf, so he was way ahead of his time. You're exactly right. But I'm seeing signs of that. In Detroit, I just talked about how hard things are in my hometown. But the Capuchin fathers there have given away hundreds of thousands of plants, seeding a community gardening movement all over the Motor City, hundreds of plots on vacant land, abandoned lots, land that people don't own, but they grow food there. So unemployed people are finding work and growing good, local, healthy food, and it's building community. And Schumacher's talking about community as a foundation for economics. And I think I'm seeing local churches, congregations, mosques, synagogues reconnecting with their communities around jobs and even credit unions and hunger. And, you know, this could be a chance to reconnect us as communities and to hold Wall Street accountable. So the crisis is structural. It is that. So we need new social regulation. But it's also spiritual. And so we need new self-regulation, too, and are reconnecting to each other in the process.
Thanks, Earl, for your call. Al from Fitchburg. Hi, Al.
Hi.
Hi.
As I was listening to this, I had this question about, as you were saying, there need to be some anger and concern about change in regulation of the banks. And I was wondering, what's the connection between what you're talking about and the anger expressed by the Tea Party people?
Great question. Anger is a natural response to exclusion and lack of fairness and just outrageous behavior that doesn't take other people into account. But it can lead either to new energy for change. We've had powerful populist movements that where anger turns into energy and hope for change. We've also had some pretty ugly populist movements where anger turns into attacks and a blaming and a scapegoating, and there's always often a lot of racism involved as well. And the Tea Party movement, I think, is a combination of genuine anger and feeling left out, and they bailed out those guys, and nobody's bailing out me, and I'm on my own, but also some real ugly anger at President Obama, first black president of the United States, which is not insignificant in terms of that anger. And it's aimed at government, but not often at big business. Big government, but not big business. So what they're saying, in effect, as I listen to them, is just let the market prevail. Now, that's not going to help the little guy in the street if the market prevails. How many of us want our kids to be playing with toys made by the Chinese that no one takes a look at? How many of us want our air and water to be unprotected except by corporations' voluntary decisions not to pollute? So there's got to be some accountability here. Big government, small government isn't the issue. What is the government supposed to do? What are its proper functions? What is it obligated to do to protect the common good? So I think the anger is real, but it's not leading to a constructive program yet. So the other problem is as you talk about the Tea Party movement, is the populism there is all on the right. And on the progressive side, there's been a lot of quiet. And maybe that's what happens when, you know, you have friends in the administration and you're on conference calls and you feel like there's a danger to access here. And the progressive side has felt access since the election. And yet we've not had a lot of results, a lot of outcomes that have been very encouraging. And so I think we need to reengage in terms of visible, strong, public, even in the streets, political organizing around things like financial regulatory reform. And I think the country needs to hear from not just one side of the spectrum, but all sides in this very difficult controversy.
And, you know, it's everywhere, the stories, and you hear them more than most people because of the work that you do and the heart that you have. But if you just listen, I was getting my hair cut yesterday, and this woman, wonderful woman who cuts my hair, who's, you know, a singer and got a lot of life, and we were talking about politics and health care reform. And she said, well, I don't have health care. Very few of my friends have health care.
Right.
It just sort of knocks you over, and you say, wait a second.
Right.
Now I can't get dental care, got a problem with my tooth, it's infected, and you're just so close to having it devastate your life. I mean, and so you hear, well, this is a big government takeover. As you say, we're just going to let the market prevail on this. What about all those people, and there are so many of them, Jim, who are really hurting?
Well, healthcare is now back in the news, and there was a great story in the New York Times on Sunday about what would happen if nothing passes.
Yes, exactly.
And how people's premiums will increase, how 1 million more people every year will lose their health insurance, how bankruptcies will escalate, and how many more people will die because of not having health insurance. I'm hearing stories like you are all the time. A woman told us a story about her breast cancer surgery was scheduled, which is traumatic enough, and then it was canceled by her insurance company because of a previous existing condition, acne. And these stories, when I'm getting call-ins now to this book, I'm hearing all these stories, and I'm meeting people on the road, and so it's below the radar screen, but all of us now have. The poor are not just the other. They're out there. They're not. They're, people are in our parishes, our pews, our families, our neighborhoods, our blocks. And my fear, Kathleen, is if we go back to business as usual, go back to normal, all the suffering will have been in vain. But if we can learn from this crisis, if the crisis causes us to do a fundamental values reset, then perhaps the Great Recession could even be redemptive in the end, but only if we find together what a new normal looks like.
Betty is next from Oak Creek. Hi, Betty.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is really making me angry. I know that the CEOs make tons more than the average worker, but 400 and some percent.
Right.
Give me a break, and the poor stiff out there trying to just make ends meet. And, of course, who do they cut? They want these wages to give back wages for the CEO to even make more. And it doesn't seem to me that this is what our Constitution is for people to get greedy. And what really irks me is when you hear this cry about, oh, it's socialism, you know, when they want to get some decent health care for everyone to be covered. Well, what is it called when the CEO makes 450% more than the average worker?
What is that called, Jim?
Well, you know, this is the anger is really growing because this is exactly what's happening. If there is socialism right now, it's socialism for the banks. Because they were failing. They screwed up. They got themselves and us in a mess. And so we bailed them out. Now, Elizabeth Warren, this Harvard law professor, economist, so here's how she puts it. She said, so we give them money, this is the big banks, to go bet on Red 21 in Las Vegas. And if they win, they get rich. If not, we pick up the bill. Now the people in Detroit are not getting socialized or subsidized. They're not being helped. But the people who are being helped are the ones who need the least help and did this in the first place. It's an amazing kind of, Dylan Radigan called it corporate communism, I think his phrase was. He was angry. We're subsidizing the top and not people at the bottom or in the middle. So there's a fundamental economic crisis. Injustice. It is a moral issue. It's not just, you know, finances are complicated, but you've got to break out the moral issues here. So I think we have to break out the moral issues here and say, let's talk about the kind of country we want our kids to grow up in. And I think that there's a chance here for a movement if our anger turns into movement energy and not the danger, Kathleen, is cynicism. Because cynicism always blocks change. If they can just make us cynical and withdraw, and we're kind of cynical and angry all the time, but nothing changes, then we're continuing to be in a more difficult situation, and we're more and more feeling like we're not part of things. So it's time to talk about movement here, I think Washington needs to understand that people in the country are going to mobilize, are going to organize around the common good. This is really, as we've been hearing from your callers, this is not the way it's supposed to be, and we sense that. This is not the way it's supposed to be.
We do sense that. Jim Wallace is our guest. His book is Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. For this hour, if you can pledge $150 or pool your resources with others to pledge $150, we'll be happy to, if you would like, send you a copy of Jim's book, which you can then pass around, Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. We get messages from people during the day. Dana from Woodbury, Minnesota, pledged today, a substitute teacher who's contributing a full day's pay to Wisconsin Public Radio this morning, and that's a sacrifice, I'm sure, for Dana. Listening to the many wonderful topics on my drive to and from work is often my resource for bringing ideas into classroom discussions. All right, that's what we attempt to do every day. I thank WPR for providing such rich and substantial topics to my students. This is the Ideas Network. A couple more phone calls in a moment. All right. I'm not sure what we were getting there, but let's go back to phone calls. We go to Eugene next from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
I go back a little ways. I'm 71 years old. And I go back to the 60s, and I've got a friend of mine who started in business about the same time I bought the house here. And we both started with nothing, practically, just a few $100s. And we made it work. And that, along with the trust of the people around us, and we both agreed, well, he's still in business, and I still got the house, but we both agreed we would never be able to do this in this day and age. It just wouldn't work.
Why? What wouldn't work, do you think?
I don't think you can start out small like that again. Because you've got too many big, you've got Walmart and the big box stores and everybody around you, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, at that point in time and space, in this small town, you could buy a good home for $8,000 or $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
You paid for it in a few years' time. You didn't go 30 years on a mortgage. You were making enough money to support your family and also to pay your mortgage.
Right. I was talking to somebody yesterday how that, you know, we pride ourselves on, in America, being the opportunity society. That's part of our self-consciousness. But now opportunity, mobility, has dramatically decreased in this country. And now there's more opportunity for people to do what you did in Europe than here, because of the way the deck is stacked against people in the middle. And so everything now is, that's why I agree with your past caller, the socialism thing is such a lie, because if there is socialism, it is socialism for the wealthiest. For example, the big controversy over reconciliation now in the Senate health care, well, reconciliation is what Republicans used to pass the Bush tax cuts, and that's gotten out. But what hasn't been made clear is the Bush tax cuts cost us as a nation twice what health care is going to cost us, twice. And so the party that's against health care reform, and they say it's because of their commitment to fiscal responsibility, They'll be fiscally irresponsible if that irresponsibility helps the richest. But I read this when I was in the L.A. train station on the way to a book tour stop, and all around me were low-income, moderate-income people who take trains. And it was clear to me that there's no fiscal commitment to them, but the commitment is to the richest. Now, this is just, for me, it's a reversal of my Christian values. I mean, the Bible says clearly it's a suspicion of the wealthy and a lifting up of the poor. It's a reversal of so many of our values here. So I think we want the kind of country where Eugene and people like him can do what they did. But that hope is slipping away unless we change it.
Jim, thank you so much. I'm sure that you would agree that it's a good idea for people to pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio whatever they can so these kinds of ideas can be front and center.
Well, Kathleen, let me lead by example here. I love your show. I've been on your show. Sign me up for a $20 pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio and write to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you, Jim. Carry on, sir.
Okay,
thank you. Take care. Jim Wallace, the book is Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. And for those of you who can pledge $150 or pledge your resources, this is the kind of book you want to pass around. So $450 pledge today, which I know this station is worth at least that much to you. If you can afford it, we will be happy to send you this very, very good book. 888-202-2552 is the pledge number, or the website is WPR.org. Joining me again in our Milwaukee studios, because she is the Milwaukee manager of Wisconsin Public Radio, is, let me get my papers here right, Lisa Nalbandian. Hello, Lisa.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi. We're in our membership drive, and we want to remind people it only takes a few minutes of your time to pledge. And we ask you to please invest in your future by donating now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Well, we need to hear from 10 more people in roughly the next 10 minutes. And thanks if you've already given. If not, help us stay on track by making your contribution right now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. You decide the amount of your pledge, and when you give $150, ask for the book, Rediscovering Values, by this hour's guest, Jim Wallace. Pledge now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
I know you've been enjoying the conversation with Jim Wallace, and think about the body of work that he has given us over the past, 35, 36 years. He's been faithful to the message of caring about the poor, and now the message becomes even more urgent as the gap between those who have and those who haven't gets wider and wider. You simply don't hear these kinds of conversations anywhere, do you? They happen here. So please take a few minutes to make this hour and many hours to come on this topic and many others. Next hour, it's Patti Smith. That'll be a great conversation as well. Put a value on the programming that you enjoy every day, the important programming that we give to you, and make your pledge. WPR.org or 888-202-2552. If you can pledge $150, we'll be very happy to send you Jim's latest book, Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street.
And thanks to those who have already given this hour. Robert from Sheboygan, Michelle from Eau Claire, Marcy from Janesville, and a special thanks to Dana in Woodbury. She's a substitute teacher who pledged a full day's pay to Wisconsin Public Radio. So that's pretty amazing. So pledge right now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552. And remember, when you pledge $120 or more, you can choose Food for 40 as your thank you gift. And this thank you gift will provide 40 meals to those facing hunger in your area and neighborhood. So for more information on Food for 40 and to make your pledge, go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Yeah, that's a great thing we're offering, and very appropriate for this hour for Jim, who's worked on poverty issues for a long time. Giving at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 is really very easy. It just takes a gift of a dollar or two a week, a few minutes of your time. A dollar or two a week adds up to about $50 or $100 for the year. And you'll, all year long, every single day, it's pretty incredible what happens here every day, you'll benefit from this program and all of the WPR programs that you love. Please make your contribution now. We're up to 19 pledges, and our goal is 25 pledges today, particularly for this kind of quality programming that looks at what our values are as a society. It's really important conversation. I think it is, and I know a lot of you do as well. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And as you're calling right now to make your pledge, you might be wondering, how much should I give? Well, it's up to you. Your contribution of any amount will be turned into great programs, programs that will keep you informed and entertained all year long. Go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 and right now and make your pledge in any amount. When you do, you play an essential part in funding the programs you count on every single day. Make your pledge right now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We have a pledge here, Lisa, from Michelle from Eau Claire, who listens all the time and has never donated. And I know that maybe one of you, two of you are in the same situation as Michelle. The program is wonderful, she says, informative and balanced. My donation is long overdue. Thank you, Michelle, so much. And your donation may be overdue or you want to update it. It's all right. You know, it's all right to come to us later. We need you now. WPR is listener supported. Some of you may not be aware of that, but it means that we rely on listeners for a significant part of our budget. When you choose to make a leadership contribution of $1,000 or more, you'll be supporting Wisconsin Public Radio in a significant way. Not everybody can afford to contribute right now, and your leadership gift may be all the more important. So if you have, it's a great time to give. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552 with your contribution of any amount.
The success of this fund drive simply depends on you. And thank you so much if you've already given. If not, give right now. We're just in the final minute or two of this hour. You decide the amount of your pledge. And remember, when you give $150, ask for the book, Rediscovering Values, by this hour's guest, Jim Wallace. Pledge now, WPR.org. 888-202-2552.
People are always asking about books for book clubs. This is one. This is the kind of thing that will really get important, meaningful conversation going. Your book club will go over time, I think. Thanks, Lisa, very much. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader. Thanks to John Munson for helping us out with Pledge. And thanks, everybody, for really caring about important issues and for pledging. It's good. It's good. This is the Ideas Network. News is next. We'll be back.